Welcome to episode 4 of the Whitchurch Silk Mill podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Umpleby, and joining me is Shannon, our weaver tackler, and Ellie Fisher, returning to introduce this show's topic on the loom. So one of the things that we find a lot with people visiting the mill is that their main expectation is to see a factory floor full of looms clacking away, weaving downstairs. And as we have discussed in the previous episodes, there is much more to the weaving process here with the time and effort it takes to prepare a warp on the top floor. But of course, seeing one of the heritage looms in motion is probably the best part of the experience. But of course, there is still a lot of work to do before the loom kicks into action, and that goes as far back as planning which loom is going to be used, how the warp is going to be joined on. So Shannon, I know one of the things that the weaving team has been working on, is each loom has its own kind of quality, doesn't it? So when we say quality, what does that mean?
So when we mean quality, I'll talk about maybe you've got a herringbone. So, you know, you get that, like, it's like little fishes, it zigzags across, changes the twill, changes direction. So you've got a herringbone, so it's a type of pattern, a type of woven cloth. You can have ottoman, again, another type of woven cloth. So you're talking about different varieties of woven cloth. So ottoman get used in legal gowns and things like that, or it could be a raw silk, so that's a different quality, so it's lighter. So we've got numbers on our looms currently, but we're trying to work towards getting it back to how it would have been, where each loom had its own quality of silk that it would have worked with. So you would have had, say, what we now call loom 15, it would have been the ottoman loom. So that loom would have just woven that quality of silk. So it's quite a thick ribbed silk. So that loom's set up to it. So, 'cause with looms, we have to change it to pick up different densities and to work with different weights of different silks. So if you've got one that's always set up to that particular weight and that particular woven cloth, then you don't have to keep changing it. And it's better for the loom as well, because you're not moving on the mechanisms, you're not changing it all the time, putting different gears in, you're not messing the loom about. So it keeps the loom happy. You're less likely to have issues with it. You usually can just put the next warp in because it'll be the same type of quality, and the loom will be happy to do that because that's what it's already been set up to do. So if you have a loom for each one, so we're trying to get back to, rather than calling it loom 1 or loom 7, we've got the ottoman loom or the ribbons loom or the raw silk loom or the herringbone loom. So they're then set up to that quality of silk, mm-hmm. So that weight of silk, that structure of silk. You're not changing all the information all the time to pick up different patterns. It's the same thing. It's better for the looms.
Mm-hmm. And it saves you a lot of time.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And a lot less fiddling about with the looms and making them temperamental. So, yeah, a lot less time.
So happy weavers all round if you've got happy looms.
Happy looms, happy weavers.
Happy weavers. So, essentially, each loom is better at doing a particular thing.
I mean, they could all do what we've asked them to do, but yes, if we've set it up to that particular type of fabric that we're trying to weave, that will be better than doing it than the other, because we've got to change it, we've got to upset it in order to, and like you say, it'll take a lot less time because we've not got to figure out how it works better and we haven't got to tune it quite as much at the beginning. Mm-hmm. It's already set to do that. We can just put a new warp in, pull it through and off it goes. So it pushes production up. Mm-hmm. And we can get a lot more out.
Brilliant. So on that note then, we've got different types of loom. Can you just tell us a little bit about the ones that we have at the mill?
Yep, so we've got main two looms. We've got a tappet, which are our older looms, and we've got our dobbies, which are our younger looms. A tappet is usually a slightly basic, more basic structure, so they're only really going to work on your plain weaves, which if you imagine weaving, I don't know if anyone... You know, it's literally under, over, under, over, under, over. So it's a very basic, you know, structure or a twill and, you know, like your denim diagonal. So they're relatively basic patterns to work through. And the information that feeds to the shafts, so these great big panels that go across that hold these teeny tiny little, almost like thin bars that are quite flexible, with teeny tiny, like, needle eyes in the middle, they hold every single thread. So when we're threading up the loom, as you thread it, each individual thread is going through an individual and then and being separated onto different shafts. So most of them, we work from 4 to 8 shafts. So the tappets tend to work on 4 or 6 because they don't have the most complex patterns that we're working with them. So that information on the side of the loom, which is the tappet block, hence it's called dab tappet, it's like a, inside is like a wiggly line, and these rollers, when they roll up over this wiggly line, it pushes a bar above the loom, which picks off the shaft, and then all those threads that have been threaded through that particular shaft will lift, and then that will start creating your pattern. So I know it very, some very complicated, and it's one of them things again where it's quite difficult unless you've seen it, but so that loom kind of gives that information there. So because it kind of works on these rollers where it drops and picks up, it's a bit more simple than our dobbies. Mm-hmm. The dobbies, we tend to just work mostly with 8 shafts. We don't really go much less than that, maybe 6, because you've got more control, you can do more patterning with them. So they have something, and I know everyone's thinking, oh, Dobby, little elf. No. it's a loom, I promise, and it has all of its information coming from the top, and it's come from what is called a Dobby chain. It's not a big, clunky chain used to fuse things together. I mean, you're probably looking more at it, the way it links as a chain, like a daisy chain. Mm-hmm. So it's more about it linking together is why it's called a chain. And it's got what's called, that's comprised of what's called pegs and lags. So it's a bit like coding this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, early doors computers.
Wow.
So with this, your pegs and lags, it's a bit like, I don't know if you've ever seen punch cards. Mm-hmm. So you kind of almost, you've got all these little holes on this long piece of, they're like little strips of wood that sit next to each other that are all joined together like a daisy chain, all linked together. Mm-hmm. And in that, you've got these little weird, like little metal clips that stick into these holes. Everywhere you put one of these little clips into one of these holes, tells the loom when it runs over these, and it, the chain, because the chain moves whilst the loom moves, so it rotates around each one of these little wooden planks, like boardwood planks. Mm-hmm. So it moves around these little planks. I mean, this thing's only about 6 inches wide. And the chain's not normally any longer than 30 centimetres. So it's not massive, we're not thinking something big. But every time it clinks round the loom, it pushes the little clippy things, push up these little knives, which, like the tappets, that then tells the loom the correct shaft to pick up. Mm-hmm. And then that picks up the right threads. Mm-hmm. So those threads are coming up, all the other ones are sitting down. Your weft to right, your left is mm-hmm. going through. And then when it closes down, it will pick up other ones and it will bring a reed forwards. So a great big reed was like we had on the warping mill. So mm-hmm. again, it's like a really fine comb. I don't know if you ever had them really horrendous knit combs.
Yes.
Yeah, one a bit like that.
Torture from childhood, yes.
Oh, yeah, you're definitely. I mean, I can hear the screams now. But with silk, they're really fine like those because the silk's very fine. So when that comes, when you're threading it up, it's gone through all those little eyes I was talking about, and it goes all through those little reed dents. So each tooth in the comb, you're putting, 2 or 3 threads, depending on what you're threading up. Mm-hmm. So once the weft has gone through, when the reed comes forward, so it moves forwards, all these are moving parts, mm-hmm. and it beats it all together, and it compresses it and pushes it up together. And that's what locks that thread in. And then you're picking up the next one. So these will be different shafts. Mm-hmm. So that little dobby chain with that little clip has told the shafts to pick up something different. And then that locks the next ones in. So the most basic, like I was saying, was a plain weave, which in silk terms we call a taffeta. Again, weaving, it has multiple different terms for similar things, and it all means different stuff. Mm-hmm. So with that, say for instance, plain weave, you pick up all the threads that are on odd numbers, so all your odd numbered threads, so like thread 1, 3, 5, etc., will pick up and then go back down, and the ones next to it, so all your even numbers will then pick up, and then that will all go through. So you're kind of, rather than doing it by hand, which I know a lot of schools you probably did do that a little bit with mm-hmm. a bit of fabric, and you did it under and over these little bits of threads that you put around a piece of cardboard, it's basically the loom is doing that for us. So instead of us having to move our hands up and down and under and over each individual thread, it's picking them threads up. Mm-hmm. So that a shuttle, which is a long wooden, I mean, there's lots of different types of shuttle, but the ones we use downstairs, it's like a, we call it, they're called shuttle boats. So imagine like a little canoe with metal in either end of it, just, you know, so it's got a bit of weight to it. They're quite hefty things, which hold the pern, which in the previous episode we spoke about the pern winder, mm-hmm. Which winds these like little pegs with all the weft on it, mm-hmm. then connects onto that, and then that gets flung from one side of the loom to the other, mm-hmm. And that's the weft going under and over the threads. So when that lifts up and it leaves that gap for the thread to go through, mm-hmm. we call that the shed, and yeah. the threads go through.
Amazing. So the Dobby chain then does play quite an important part.
Yes.
So it's very much like the computer code, the loom reads it.
Yeah,
and that's how
exactly
that.
Like that.
So all those like iPads and computers that we use today, that is essentially stemming from a really...
Yeah, I suppose it is, yeah, a very basic computer. It's mm-hmm. literally you're giving it the most basic information you possibly can in the most basic way, but you've given that information, you've programmed that loom, and you've given it that information to do what you want it to do.
Amazing. Okay. So really, like, clever. Really clever machines. Yeah. Amazing to watch. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just going back to our previous episode, we were talking about bringing the beam down, which has all the warp threads. So that was the big rolling pin, wasn't it, with the spaghetti on?
Spaghetti rolling pin.
That's it. And it comes down through, well, it used to come down through the floors, and now you carry it downstairs. Mm-hmm. So when we get to that point in the weaving shed, what happens to that beam? How do you, like, set up the loom?
Cool. So from there, really at the early stages of threading up that loom, so first thing we do is at the back of the loom, you've got these little holders. Mm-hmm. They're literally just either little holes either side that keep the beam up, because the beam, aka the rolling pin, has these little, it narrows a bit onto these little metal bits, that like a smaller beam, essentially a smaller ring, that they then slot into either side. So that loom will then hold that beam up. Mm-hmm. We'll then have weights go round. So our loom rates, we've got a big piece of rope. Mm-hmm. On either side, you've got very heavy weights on either side of those rope. So it gets wrapped round that beam several times, and then the back hangs. So that and there's one either side of the beam. So it's keeping that tension on it, because once you've threaded that up, there's nothing to hold that beam in place. It could just keep unravelling. Mm-hmm. So you need it to find a good balance where the weight is going to hold that beam steady. So from there, we can thread up our loom. So like I was saying, every individual thread then gets threaded through each individual eye. And another thing maybe we didn't mention to the warping was making the cross. So when it was done on the warp, there was a cross put in. So every other thread... you put one goes over a stick and one goes under a stick.
Right.
So it makes a little cross. So that means that they can't go wherever they want. So they're all in order, especially if you have a stripe, you really need that to be in order. Mm-hmm. So that means when I take the first one, I know that's number one, because there's no way it could have crossed onto another one, because it's only going to go under that beam. Because cross sticks, they're big stick things, like they go across quite thin sticks. Mm-hmm. Because it goes under that stick and the other one goes over it, it can't cross over it. So I take that thread, and that goes through that first heddle, which is that little eye thing I was talking about. It looks like a little needle.
Yeah.
And then you go all the way across, depending on what your pattern is. Usually they're quite straightforward, so we just thread one to, say we've got eight shafts. Mm-hmm. I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. And it's, you know, some people call it tedious. I kind of find it quite therapeutic. I think most
you call it art.
I call it art. Yeah, we find it therapeutic. I think most weavers that thread a lot, you'll find that a lot of them will find it quite therapeutic, because you kind of get in a zone and you're just like, threading this up, and you're just like, usually you can have some music going, just bobbing away to it. yes, so that goes through there, and again through the reed. The knit comb. And then we tie it onto another beam. So this is the front beam. So a bit like the one at the back, slightly bigger. Mm-hmm. It all gets individually tied on, which holds it in place. And then once it's all tied on like that, that loom is ready to start going. There's a few tweaks, but it's very complicated.
It does sound really complicated. I think with the intricacies of it as well, pulling all those threads through. You must, your eyesight must be incredible to do that.
A lot of the looms, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but they've all got some of them have got white paint underneath them. So when you're threading up, very rare that we thread up white, but if we do, we can put other colour down there. But it kind of makes the floor a different colour. It makes it brighter, so you can see the threads easier. Because they're so fine, and you've got that background on the bottom, it, rather than it being all cloudy floorboards and stuff, and you know you can't see what's going on, you've got this nice white bit underneath. That means that when you look down, you can see your threads. So it kind of gives it a good background. So it's not busy, so you can see the thread.
You can see it. Amazing. And just how many threads are you pulling through, just on average?
Completely different per one. Most recent one I've done, 8,000.
8,000 threads.
8,000 threads through all those little eyes. Wow. And then 8,000 threads through the knit comb.
So you 16,000 times. Yes. In some ways. Yeah, that's incredible. Wow. So no wonder you're good at maths.
Well, you did that maths. I just nodded along with it and said yes.
My maths teacher would be proud. So once you've done all of that, then you talked a little bit about the actual weaving process. So that was the lifting of the shafts, wasn't it? Making the gap and the shuttle passing through. Part of your job is having to monitor that, isn't it, as well? So once you've done that.
So it's not just flick the loom off and walk away, because a lot of the time all sorts of things can happen. You walk around the back, you can see what we call criddlers. So this is probably not a term that they might use in other mills, might not. It's one of those things where, you know, everywhere has its own little way of saying it. But it's kind of like a frayed thread. So you can see it's about to go, it might break. So instead of allowing it to break and where it could cause a fault in your work, you've got opportunity because you've watched it from the back and you've caught it. You can go around, turn the loom off, and then we can cut that bit out, tying knots. And the way we tie knots, weaver's knot, means the threads lay flat. So it's very unlikely that you're going to see that in the work. But obviously then when we go to inspect it, we can check that and pick out anything that we might need to. Working from the back kind of helps. You also, the loom can do whatever it fancies whenever it likes sometimes, so you can have all sorts of problems, but generally speaking, I mean, you think how old these things are and the fact that they still run as well as they do, it's quite impressive actually. But there are safety mechanisms on them in place, so if a shuttle decides to jump out, which has been known, the mill has got countless stories of shuttles deciding to jump out, pelting the wall, making dents, one coming out of a window. I think there was a story, wasn't there, about weavers having to hitch up their skirts and go fish the shuttle out of the river. I've not had to do that, so it's okay. Now we have grates and guards up in the windows, so they're not going out of there because I think they just, I don't know, I'm not going to fish it out. And if one decides to jump out, the loom now, it knows, so the way the shuttle goes into the what we call the shuttle box, so on either side it's holding these little boxes, which is where it gets flung back out again, by these six sticks that kind of pelt it, they kind of smack it across. So it goes into these shuttle boxes on either side of the loom, on either side of your warp, and in there is what we call a sweller, so it kind of pushes in the pressure and it holds the shuttle in place. It's like a little like spring-loaded thing. And if the shuttle's not in there, the loom knows, because it's not pushed back on that spring, and two bits of metal hit together and it bangs the loom off. And from there, the loom shuts off. It's knocked the handle off.
Right.
So that's what you're watching as well. Because if you walked off, you had no idea that your production stopped because your shuttle's come out and the loom's banged off and nothing's weaving. You have to keep an eye on it.
Wow.
There's no saying, okay, Loom, you do your job, I'm going to go and have a cup of tea, because there's no way. Yeah, it instantly finds something for you to do. And you've got to change the patterns as well, because you've only got so much yarn that will fit on that little peg that goes in that shuttle. So you've got to watch for that as well, because if you let that run out, it's just going to keep chucking the loom. It's not going to know it's run out. It's just going to keep chucking that shuttle across, and there's going to be a nice big gap. Then you have to try and fix it. You don't always get away with it.
So it's like watching a naughty toddler all the time.
Yeah, it really is, actually. I've never thought of it like that, but it really is.
So thanks, Shannon. That was brilliant for taking us through the weaving journey here at the mill. There's just so much that goes into it all. And it's been brilliant to hear all the details. And of course, we do invite our listeners to come and see us at the mill and to see you and the looms in action. So now we are joined by Ellie Fisher from Elka Textiles. Thanks so much for joining us on our podcast once again. And you're going to be chatting to us a little bit more about your work and working on a modern handloom compared to some of our traditional machines at the mill. So just to remind everybody, Ellie, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself?
So my business, Elka, is a hand-woven textile business, and I design and hand weave fabrics for fashion and furnishing, and I also teach quite a lot of weaving as well.
So when you're going about weaving, teaching or setting up your own loom, what kind of loom do you have?
So my loom that I've had for the last 4 years is a 32 shaft Luet Magado. Luet are a Dutch company, they make fabulous looms. Mine is their sort of flagship loom. It's a little bit, with how my weaving has evolved, it's a little bit excessive for me having 32 shafts, but I do quite often use all 32 of them just because I know they're there. But the actual process of setting the loom up, so making the warp and putting it onto the loom, is all done manually. And then once you're weaving, I design on software called Fiberworks. So I design my patterns on that, and then you connect your computer to the loom, and your computer tells the loom which shafts to lift, so it works on electromagnets, so you're not having to remember, because of the 32 shafts, you'd have to memorize sequences. If you were doing it manually, you'd have to memorize sequences of up to 32 numbers, which is just not doable, especially not for my brain. So it lifts the shafts for you. You're still treadling with your foot, so you push your foot down on a pedal underneath the loom and it lifts the relevant shafts. You throw the shuttle across by hand and then you release the pedal and push it down again to lift the shafts up.
Really interesting, because compared to what we have at the mill, obviously we've got industrial 200-year-old machinery and, you know, all those power looms, but it is also very manual as well. So all the setting up of it, all the lift, you know, it's all really, really manual labour, really. So to have a mixture of digital and manual, do you find that's kind of easier? Or
I certainly find, having worked on completely manual hand looms, having the electronic element to it speeds things up. If you want to produce textiles to sell, it has to have really that element to it if you want to make a profit on it. But I always take, I bought some of your bobbins from the mill that have got the silk on them. And when my students are complaining about how fine the threads are I use, I always crack out one of the bobbins that you guys have got with the super, super fine sort of hair fine silks, and show them that it could be a lot worse. in setting up the loom, you know, I said this could take you months.
Absolutely,
it makes me then look terribly generous.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things a lot of the weavers comment on a lot, especially when we have new ones come in for training. Your eyesight has to be impeccable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because it's so fine. And I think Shannon, when she said about her first time weaving silk, I think it was raw silk, and it was just, you couldn't see it almost. It was incredible. So, but 32 shafts, that's a huge amount.
It is. What it means I can do then is allocate particular shafts for my selvages. So with all my scarves and also with my upholstery fabric, I do like to, if I can, have a selvage in a different pattern. And I use one not in a plain weave, generally in a small detailed pattern that just keeps the edges nice and neat. And I just think it finishes off the scarves quite nicely. I'd say I never use them, but I do actually. I do. There's several 32 shaft patterns that I do use, and then for those, you then have to have floating selvages at the edge, because you're not allocating shafts to them, so you're catching the floating selvages every time you throw the shuttle across to keep the edges nice and straight. But really, the Magado, there's so much it can do. And I'm quite basic in how I weave. It took me a very, very long time to learn how to weave at university, and sort of a good year longer for the penny to drop technically than my peers. And I always joke that's why I carried on weaving, because I just couldn't bear the thought of investing so much energy into learning something new in case I found it that hard again. But so my loom is a lot brighter than I am, and I'm not sure I'll ever unleash its full potential. But as I come out of the sort of I got it just before I had my daughter Frankie, and lovely Alex, who was doing work experience for me at the time, who was meant to be coming and having sort of a few weeks of weaving and really hands-on experience, ended up sort of on the floor of my studio and set the whole loom up for me pretty much. And then Dawn and Alan from the Handweaver Studio up in London had to come down and finish off the really technical bits for me, because it was so overwhelming. It was so different to anything I'd ever woven on before, and so much bigger as well. It weaves 1.30 meters wide, whereas I was weaving on a much smaller 24 shaft arm loom prior to that, and that's what I'd woven on at university as well. So I'm just every time I weave on it I learn something new. And again, social media is really so inspiring for sort of seeing what other people are doing, and there's quite a lot of people with Louis Magado, so it's wonderful seeing actually what you can do on it. is mind-boggling, really. And there's some really, I mean, technically brilliant weavers out there who one of them is Jeremy Uden, who I hope I've pronounced that right. He's I've only seen his work through Instagram, but he experiments with so many different patterns, and I find that really inspiring. I think that's fantastic.
It's really like surprising to hear that there's so many different types of loom as well. You know, and can you sort of do the same thing on the loom, or is the weave different on different looms you use? Or?
There are so many. But as far as what they actually do, their functionality is the same. The more shafts you've got, the more possibilities are opened up for pattern. But really, you know, you can weave on a table loom or on my sort of bigger loom. It depends how you set the warp up and how thick the threads are that you use, but you can do sort of tapestry loom weaving and rug loom weaving on those kind of looms as well. They're just they're more commonly used for producing sort of finer cloths, but yeah, within, I mean, they've all got their different sort of, I can't think of the word for it, but they've all got their different sort of parameters. But what you can actually produce on them is fairly, from like a fabric thickness point of view, pretty similar.
And what sort of things do you produce? What sort of things are you weaving?
At the moment, I am I'm weaving. Well, I've stopped producing scarves really that are not commissions. So with my scarf commissions, if someone commissions me to weave a scarf, I tend to then make the warp so it'll weave 4 or 5 scarves long. So I'll do the commission and then I'll weave a few for my stock. But if I was, I became a bit of a scarf weaving machine, and I want to break away from that because it's very labour intensive, and actually what you can then charge for it doesn't really add up hours wise. So really, you'd sort of sub if you really wanted to make money out of it, you'd subcontract out to a mill. And I have been talking to the Bristol Weaving Mill, who they're a fabulous mill that's I'm not sure when they set up, but really up together and do small commission runs, which makes it feasible for people like me to get smaller runs of things done. It's another project that's in the pipeline. There's just so much going on. I just haven't found time to pursue that. But I'm very focused at the moment on my wire weaving and weaving bigger one-off pieces, because I just feel that's ticking the creativity box for me. And it's making me remember why I love weaving so much. And it's kind of pushing me to think of new things to do. And that seems to be coming quite naturally now. I've kind of forced myself down that route. So for me, that's really the future of my personal side of the business is sort of moving, and I will still do commissions, but I need to fulfill the creative side for myself to kind of have the motivation to keep pushing forwards with everything.
Oh, sounds really fascinating, and best of luck with going forward as well, because I imagine there'll be some beautiful things that you'll be creating. And when you're teaching your students or doing your workshops, what kind of looms do you use with them?
So I'm a bit of a diehard Luray fan, and I'm terribly biased just because I weave on one myself, but I think for what you can get for your money, as far as functionality goes, you can't get much more for your money on that front. They're really fantastic bits of kit, and they're really easy to assemble at home on your own. I always recommend when people buy a Luray loom that they do actually assemble it themselves, just because it really kind of shows you how it all fits together and everything sort of fits into place once you're weaving. So I teach on really small four-shaft Erica looms. They're called Erica looms. They're smallest table loom, and they come in a 30 centimetre weaving width and a 50 centimetre weaving width. I teach on the 30 centimetre ones just because they then pack away nice and easily, and I can fit more of them into a space. But for table loom weaving, they're a really nice introduction to weaving. But I've reduced my class sizes down recently. I was teaching up to 5 people how to weave on a table loom at once, but I just find that if you get more than one person that's struggling with certain elements, you're losing the quality of teaching. So I've reduced my workshop sizes down to 3 people per workshop, and it's just more relaxed for everybody, and you can cover more ground. And actually, as of the new year, I will only be carrying on with private tuition, because I'm so busy with other elements of my business that I'd just rather kind of have a really intensive sort of 1 or 2 days with people, so where they're getting so much more out of that learning experience that you can teaching one person how to weave on a table loom, you can teach them so much more than when you're teaching in a group setting. That I just feel that's appropriate for me moving forwards.
Brilliant. Okay. And how big are the looms? You know, do you have to have a quite big space to put them all in, or
For the ones that I teach on, they're just over 30 centimetres wide, because you've got the 30 centimetre weaving width. So people can't see the width of this table, but they're no bigger than the width of this table. And okay. The castle, which is the frame that holds the shafts, you can lift that up and you can lie it flat. So when they're not in use, you can sort of flatten it all down, even with a warp on the loom. They come on, you can either sit them on a table, or you can get them with a stand, which also takes apart really easily. So they're tiny, teeny tiny little things. They're fantastic. They look like toys. Oh. I think they look like toys. Yeah. They probably change to a lot of people.
Brilliant. It would be really cool to see one of them next to maybe one of our looms as well, just to kind of see the difference, you know, because obviously there's some big, big industrial ones, and then little ones, which are fantastic. So, and I imagine a lot of our weavers learnt on those looms as well when they started off. So they get quite sentimental when they see them in our shop and things like that, little looms, which is brilliant. So I just wanted to ask you as well about your own personal loom and how you set that up, because you've got the digital side and the manual side. So how long does it take you to put all that together?
So it really very much depends on what you're weaving. So a lot of the time involved in putting something onto the loom and weaving it is setting the loom up. Once you're actually weaving, that's relatively quick compared to setting the loom up. So just to give an example, if I was weaving, so if I used to weave collections for small shops and galleries. So if I had an order for 10 scarves, you'd set the loom up so it wove 10 scarves long. That significantly cuts down the time per scarf, because so much of that time is spent setting up the loom. So I always say, on average, for a standard size, so a standard sort of 30 centimetre width scarf that's about 1.70 metre long, it takes about a day from including the setting up of the loom, weaving it, taking it off the loom, finishing the tassels off by hand, washing it, pressing it, sewing the label on. That's around about a day of work. And then for a scarf double that width, it's about double the time. So if I was setting the loom up to weave the full width, 130 centimetres wide, and I was using, I tend to work, the yarns that I use are an organic cotton and an organic cotton and linen blend called Cotillion. They're both Venner yarns. They're a Dutch company. They're really lovely yarns to work with. And I work with them at about 28 ends per inch, about, 12 per centimetre, because the Liwe work in centimetres. And so that would take me, it'd probably take me about 4 days to set the loom up to weave. It depends on how long your warp is. So I, with the bigger bits of fabric that I get made into bags and things, I tend to weave a minimum of 10 metres long. So I think weaving for me in the way that I do it is the definition of a labour of love. I mean, it's very labour intensive. Anything can go wrong. A lot of it's problem solving. If something goes wrong with the loom, or there's issues with the yarn, or, you know, yarn has a shelf life, as you guys will know, I think with silk especially, and with that fineness of silk. So you've just got to sort of relax into it and not think about the hours so much.
And and your back aching and all sorts.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that people are quite surprised about when they come and visit the mill, and they go around and they realise how long it takes, you know, because you sort of see a finished product and you think, oh, that's lovely. But actually there is, like you're saying, so much intense work that's gone into it. And even just the taking it off the loom, preparing it for sale as well, you know, like with you, it takes a day or 2 days depending on what you're making. So that's a huge amount of time, really, isn't it? It's a lot of hours that goes into it.
It must be
it's quite lovely when you've made it. It's really proud of what you've made, but it's a lot of, like you said, a lot of love that's gone into it as well.
That's what keeps you going.
Yeah.
it's the outcome. And I think it's what I always say to people in workshops. My table loom weaving I teach over 2 days, and the first day is entirely setting the loom up, and I always feel so awful by the end of the day, because everyone feels a bit demoralized that they haven't, you know, and it's that people have struggled with either the technical aspect of setting the loom up and working out, you know, how many ends per centimeter you're working at, how, you know, all of that. And sort of I certainly learnt through doing, so I try and get them into that as quickly as possible. But it's not until the second day and they start weaving and the penny drops, and it's just like, and that's my favourite bit, is when people realise that that's why they're doing it. And it's such a lovely feeling, and it's so lovely seeing them suddenly realising what all of their hard work has gone into, and they've produced from all of these threads that they've been so angry with and so confused about. And not everyone's like that, but I certainly was like that when I started weaving. And then suddenly seeing this sort of cloth appear in front of them with a pattern running through it, and then, you know, all the possibilities then for moving forwards with it is terribly exciting and terribly rewarding. And coming back to mental health and how beneficial it is towards that, you know, really kind of creating order from all of that kind of chaos in some people's head, it certainly is in mine an awful lot of the time, is just a wonderful thing to be able to do. It's a wonderful tool to have to sort of focus you in. Yeah.
Mm. Absolutely. No, that's lovely. One of the things I wanted to ask you as well was, with your experience of working with different people, or I imagine some people that have done weaving before versus people that haven't, but also places like us as well, when you've come to see us, there's language that we use for weaving, isn't it? There's different terms for different things. We certainly have our own kind of language, which other mills think, well, we don't call it that, we call it this. Do you find that with some of the sort of terms and things you're using, do people get a bit confused? Or
100%. Yeah. And actually, at the beginning of my workshops, that's the first thing I say to people, is that YouTube is an amazing resource. There are so many people offering amazing advice and tutorials on there. You've got to sift through it to get there. But tend to recommend that people don't actually really listen too much to what they're saying, and to look at what they're doing more, because there is a huge difference in terminology between, like you're saying, within like UK mills, but between American, Scandinavian, British terminology. So what we call in the UK, or what I call plain weave, in America they call it tabby. And it gets more confusing because I've spent so much time on YouTube and I love the word tabby. So I now use the word tabby and plain weave, and that gets very confusing. So I think not to let it put you off is really important, and just go with the flow. And yeah, I love the names of where I really like looking into like the origin of words. Mm-hmm. And I found out recently, it took me ages, and I think I found it on an American blog, but the word shed, I wanted to know where that came from, and apparently it comes from an old English word which means to set apart. So where you're separating your warp threads, you're sort of setting them apart. I haven't looked into the validity of that, but I love all the terminology.
Yeah, that actually makes a huge amount of sense with the shed. I've always wondered why it was called a shed, because you think of a building, don't you, a shed, and you think, what is it called?
Yeah.
But that makes sense, separating it, doesn't it? And yeah. We recently did a series on origins of textile words on our social media and on YouTube, and it was fascinating actually diving into the things that we say all the time, common phrases and things like that. Actually, a lot of them come from the textile industry, don't they? So every time I say these phrases now, I think, oh, it comes from this. Yeah. And it's really interesting, and it's such a massive part of our culture, isn't it? And going forward, and being British identity, I suppose, isn't it? It's a textiles, industrial revolution, all that sort of thing. So it's really, really interesting where it's come from.
I do have to quickly mention The Golden Thread by Cassia St. Clair. If you haven't read it, it's the history of textiles. And she starts off by saying, of course, the word text comes from the word textiles. And that initially, it never even occurred to me before that, of course, it does. And it's so ingrained in our society and our lives that but it's an amazing book. Well worth a read.
I'll put that on my list.
Yeah.
And then the last question, what is your favourite sort of yarn to work with, do you think?
I have a love-hate relationship with it, because it can be really tricky, but linen. And my mum started working with the business about 4 years ago. I was really struggling to find genuinely sustainable yarns that weren't then dyed with really nasty chemicals. And mum has always had a real interest in that side of things. And she's very into the science side of things, and that's quite a focus on her natural dyeing workshops. But naturally dyed linen is where it's at for me. And from every aspect, from the durability of it, for tapestry loom weaving, it hangs really nice and flat. The colours that you get from the naturally dyed yarns are just, they all tone in together. They're so beautiful. I've not yet found a combination that really hurt your eyes. They're just beautiful. So naturally dyed linen is right up there.
Brilliant. That sounds amazing. All about linen, and that's your favourite yarn. Of course, we always weave with silk, but and we may get in trouble if we don't do that. But we have woven with linen before. Some of our warps are linen, and it's amazing the change in the fabric. It makes it a lovely sort of touch, doesn't it, and texture. Thanks, Ellie. It's been so lovely to hear from you, and thanks for joining us on our podcast once again.
Thank you very much for having me.
Lovely. And that's it for this episode. So please join us again next time, where we will be exploring our output in the form of ribbons, which is quite exciting. And don't forget to check out our socials or visit us in person if you are close enough, and subscribe to our podcast series. See you next time.